You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest finds a way to solve problems and create better lives using the principles of design.
First, the University of Wisconsin-Madison made headlines around the country after several women alleged they were sexually assaulted or harassed by a now-expelled student. He was arrested last year following accusations of serial sexual assault and harassment.
This is one of several campus sexual assault cases that have gotten national attention. Over the last few years, Stanford, Columbia, and other universities have been under intense scrutiny for how they deal with students accused of sexual assault and with their victims.
Under the Obama administration, there were efforts to launch broad investigations into larger patterns of discrimination after an allegation of sexual assault. But our next guest reports those wider probes could be less likely under the Trump administration.
Lucia Graves is a columnist and feature writer for The Guardian based in Washington, D.C. Lucia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to what changes under the Trump administration, what had happened under the Obama administration? What kinds of investigations were we seeing when it came to sexual assault on campuses?
Well, this was actually one of the biggest priorities for the Obama administration and consistently throughout, spearheaded by Vice President Biden, who, you know, from basically as soon as they took office, he told Obama that he wanted to have an Office of Violence Against Women within the White House rather than just at the Justice Department. And within that, he really focused on campus sexual assault. I think it was a topic close to his heart, and also under Title X, which is a education law from the 1970s barring sex discrimination at schools that received federal money. He had a real legal tool to go after schools and hold them accountable. And so they did a tremendous amount of that in the 8 years that they were there. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot of rollbacks. I think we're already seeing some just within the first 6 months of the new administration.
Right. The philosophy had been under the Obama administration, not just to investigate an individual case of sexual assault and of mistreatment, I guess, by the campus itself, by the university, but then to go beyond that and look and say, is this a wider issue? So what is changing from that now with the Trump administration? What kind of directives have we seen?
Well, so the new head of the Office of Civil Rights in the Education Department, who oversees this, is saying that in a memo, which was actually supposed to be private but was leaked to the media, presumably by a federal worker who is concerned, it says that they want to consider cases individually rather than within the wider context. So, for instance, the story that I wrote for The Guardian, I interviewed a number of women from the same school district who had various forms of abuse, ranging from rape to just violence, like partner violence, and had been let down by the same school district in similar ways. But under sort of this new ordinance, there'd be no way of looking at that pattern holistically.
And what have we heard from the Trump administration when they've talked about how they're going to approach these issues?
Well, I mean, the big context here is, you know, this is a president who, before he was elected, there was a tape that came out where he boasted about grabbing women's genitals. So I think that is important context coming in. That was the thing probably that came the closest to sort of derailing his campaign. And so that's sort of the broad context. More recently, in terms of what's been said by his new head of education, and specifically her deputy, Candace Jackson, who oversees sexual assault claims on campus, I think a lot of advocates have been very, very concerned by her. In a recent interview with the New York Times, she made a pretty widely publicized comment that she thinks 90% of accusations, quote, fall into the category of we were both drunk. So this is an administration that's going to be looking out for the rights of the accused, not the accusers, and they made that extremely clear. That was the context of that larger interview in which she said that soundbite that really caught people's attention, I think. But it's pretty clear where their priorities are, I would say.
Talking to Lucia Graves from The Guardian, looking at changes in the way the Trump administration will tackle the issue of campus sexual assault as compared to the Obama administration. And Lucia, you're focusing in a piece you wrote recently, I understand you're going to do more on this, I think, on individual women and on people who've been affected by this directly. And you talked to some of the people you were interviewing about the reaction to what they've heard from the Trump administration and those comments from the Office of Civil Rights that you just mentioned. What kind of things did you hear?
I spoke to a number of women who were filing things from the same school. One of them actually had the privilege of meeting with the Secretary of Education, and sort of, you know, making her voice heard in that way. But the day before that, she and some other advocates, and they met with people sort of on both sides of the debate. They met with some men's rights groups as well. Including, I think, disturbingly to some people, a group called the National Coalition for Men, which is a group that alleges domestic violence is overreported. But anyway, so she had a seat at the table in July, but just a day before she was scheduled to meet with the Secretary of Education, her deputy, who's in charge of campus sexual assault, comes out and makes this comment that she thinks 90% of accusers fall into the "we were both drunk" camp. So you know, it's very undermining to be trying to, you know, have your voice heard and then right before that happens, sort of have the rug pulled out from you in that way. Her quote to me was, "It's really heartbreaking and really aggravating that someone in that kind of position could have the view, that sort of view of something so serious," and it made her feel like her meeting with the secretary, quote, meant nothing in light of the comments.
Is there a sense for victims of sexual assault on campus or in school districts, in some cases, that their accusations, their experience is not being taken seriously by authorities, whether on a college campus or say, at a high school?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that until fairly recently, there was a big publicity and awareness push made by the Obama administration, and awareness is, I would say, half the battle in this case. I'm sorry, what was I saying?
I'll move on. Actually, I wanted to, before we run out of time, get into Title IX and why this might be a wider issue, that a woman victimized by sexual assault, obviously that in itself is horrible, but the idea that if this happens repeatedly and if it's not taken seriously by an institution, it would violate anti-discrimination laws. It creates, in effect, a very hostile environment. Is that part of the legal principle that is being changed here, I guess, from one administration to the next?
Yeah, well, so one of the questions that the Education Department is looking at now is sort of what the burden of proof is, and they do want to raise that criteria. Under the Obama administration, you had to have sort of a credible preponderance of evidence, and now they want to change the legal definition to be more along the lines of you have to disprove or basically be able to prove that what the accuser is saying is true in order to be taken seriously. So it just raises the bar and makes it that much harder to come forward.
We'll leave it there for now. Lucia, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Lucia Graves, columnist and feature writer for The Guardian based in Washington, D.C. Joining us to talk about how campus sexual assault investigations and civil rights related investigations could change under the Trump administration.
Coming up, our guest tells us how the principles of design can be used to create better lives. Stay with us here on Central Time. First, our next guest believes the principles of design are about a lot more than just aesthetics. She sees design as a tool to create better lives and solve real-world problems.
Leslie Sager put these ideals to work with her students at UW-Madison, building solar lights, cardboard shelters, and a women's artisan workshop in Kenya.
Leslie runs the Interior Architecture Program at UW-Madison. She's also the director of the Design Thinking for Social Innovation Initiative at the School of Human Ecology. Leslie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you have a bachelor's degree in social work and a master's in interior design. How do you see those two relating to each other?
They relate Very well, actually, because I'm very interested in the arts, but I'm also extremely interested in impacting people's lives. So combining those two things in the form of design has been a highlight for me.
And design thinking, we're starting to see this phrase and we're starting to see it put into practice in new and innovative ways. Can you walk us through that? Can you make the case that design is so much more than just putting together beautiful things or useful things, but it's something a lot bigger?
Absolutely. And I'm very passionate about this as well. A lot of people think of design as something that you make, and it is, but it is also a process. So with design thinking, what we're doing is we're applying the process that designers do every day. And it starts with empathy. The first thing we do is really think about the people that we're designing for and the importance of how they live their lives. And then we define it, and then we start to come up with ideas. And then the next step with design thinking is really all about prototyping and testing those ideas with the people so that we can very quickly make decisions whether things can move forward or whether they've failed and we need to move on.
So you start with empathy. That's interesting.
Exactly.
That's not the word I would have expected to come first. So is that the same word that you would use to begin a process, say, if you're building a lampshade versus you're trying to improve someone's life?
It could be. Building a lampshade is a little bit more product-based and it's a little more aesthetic, but we may also be thinking about the way that lampshade will shield the light in a certain situation. So we would want to think about the people that are using that light source and how that will impact the way they use it. So they're always involved.
Now, you challenged your students to create shelters for people who'd been displaced from their homes due to a natural disaster. Tell us about what they came up with.
Sure. That was actually several years ago. I became fascinated with design thinking and the process itself and how that you can come up with very innovative ideas through this process, and that it really is about divergent thinking and drawing from other resources and getting experiences from other people to come together and come up with innovative solutions. So I wanted my students to come up with cardboard disaster relief shelters that could be installed very, very quickly and transported very, very fast. And they came up with a number of them, and one of them ended up being built to full scale and put in Design Amoka back in, I think it was 2012, so it was quite a while ago.
The Madison Museum of Contemporary Art.
That's correct. That's correct.
And what did it look like, that one?
It looked a little like a yin-yang. The students wanted to create, they'd learned from the users, or the survivors, that many people, when they've been through a crisis, they really want to be able to have a time to reflect and have time to be quiet, but also they want to be around people. So they developed a shelter where it had two doors on either side, almost like a yin-yang. They were like walls, essentially, that could open when they wanted to embrace the community or close when they wanted to be alone. So it became a kind of a flexible space. And then they designed it in such a way that it was all interlocking mailing tubes, but they would also fit within each other that fit within the rooftop of the piece, so it could be easily shipped.
And did those end up getting used anywhere in just that kind of situation?
They did not, although it would be wonderful. Although what ended up happening is that somebody saw what we were doing and they were intrigued by it, and they happened to have a connection with Kenya and connected to me, thinking that perhaps these shelters would be useful in Kenya, where their buildings get washed away due to the monsoon season. And that's how I actually ended up in Kenya.
Right, and I know that's the next chapter of your design life and what you're doing now. As we talk with Leslie Sager, who runs the Interior Architecture Program at UW-Madison, and we're talking about how you can use design not just to make things function or to look beautiful, but to build better lives. And that gets us on the road to Kenya. And Leslie, tell us what happened in Kenya. What did you do there?
Sure. Well, I went there to see if building these cardboard shelters was a viable solution. And it turned out that there was interest, but the shipping was a problem. But I also wanted to see what else was happening. And while I was there, I met a woman who had started an alternative rite of passage for the girls in her region who were originally going through FGM, which is female genital mutilation. And what she was doing is she came up with another opportunity for the girls to go, another type of tradition for them to go through in lieu of something that is very unhealthy. And so I got to visit with her, and during that time I had a conversation about the fact that there wasn't enough money for the girls to go to school for school fees. And so we talked about empowering the women, the mothers of the daughters, to help them so that they can support their girls.
And I imagine there you are, and you're trying to think about design thinking to apply to how do we get these girls through school? How do we get them to continue on and have a bright future? And what did you come up with, and how did you apply that?
Well, it started with a course that I taught. I teach design thinking, and the first one I taught was about 4 years ago, I believe, through the School of Human Ecology. And I had my Kenyan friend come here, and my students applied the design thinking process, the empathy part and the defining and the ideating, and came up with different ideas of ways to empower the women in this community. One of them had to do with product development and how to support the women through the traditional crafts that they have. And that led to some wonderful opportunities with the women, where we started to work with them on color schemes, and not patterns, because we want them to maintain their traditional craft. But the students here worked with them on developing ways to create a product that they could, I could then bring back here and sell.
And it sounds like they actually, your students had a lot of ideas. Extracting oil from plants, I remember, was one of them. What were some of the other ideas that were tossed around before you settled on your course?
Well, I still run this course, and actually,
meaning
we
settled
still
on the product that you were going to emphasize.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, I've settled on several, actually. So it was the baskets was one of them that I came back and tested when I was in Kenya, and that was successful. Another one was solar-powered lights. I had some students design battery-operated solar-powered LED lights, and my requirement, my restriction, was that it couldn't cost more than $2.50 to make. And then I brought my students back, and we tested that. One of the projects that we're working on, and hopefully will be successful this year, is the oil extraction project. So every year we have a number of projects, and then every year I go back and test them in the communities. And this is all through the design thinking course. And it's really wonderful, because the course actually draws from a lot of students throughout the campus, and really speaks to our design innovation initiative, Design Thinking for Social Innovation, because it really requires that the teams are very diverse, that each member of that team has a different craft or different skill. They're either a designer, or they're an engineer, or they're in the community nonprofit leadership program. And so those skills really come together to create innovative new ideas.
So as you said, this is ongoing. Have you had the chance to see how some of this design thinking has impacted these women and their daughters in Kenya?
Absolutely. Every year I go back, or at least I have for quite a while now, about 4 years, and I meet with the same women as often as I possibly can. And I always ask them about what they've done that, or what this has, how this has benefited them. And the solar power has really helped them, because their children now are able to study at night. They're able to produce bags quicker because typically they can only work at night, and it takes them about a month to make a bag because of the fact that they're farming during the day. So they're able to make more, and they're able to make them faster. They're also feeling a lot more empowered. So one of my women friends, Eunice, was able to buy a goat the first time, and the goat was pregnant, so she got two. And then the second year, she was able to buy a bed. She'd never had a bed before, so that was the first time she'd ever had a mattress.
Wow, so those are some real tangible benefits.
Yep. And then this last time I talked to her, she was sending her girl to university, actually, which was really, really impressive. So it's pretty exciting that I'm really helping them come up with new ways of helping themselves.
So a lot of success there, but I imagine there's also fails. Do you ever, what happens when you have an idea? It sounds great. You think it's great. You did the design thinking process, but it fails, and it just doesn't work. And it somewhere along the line, something got lost.
Well, we let it go. We take the bits that we got from it that made a lot of sense, and then we sometimes have to let it go if it fails. And other times we simply reframe the question. So it's not that there isn't still a problem. We still want to solve that problem. But if we reframe the question in a different way, then sometimes we can come at a solution that works better for them.
So this is something you emphasize. We've been talking a lot about your work in Kenya, but this is something that can be applied, I think, in anyone's life, design thinking. Can you give us some ideas about how to do this, how to start with maybe a problem that needs to be solved or a way that we're looking for improvement and how to apply those same principles?
Sure. It usually is helpful to have a problem, something that you do want to solve, and to have a group of people that are interested in solving that with you, because it really is a team type activity. And to reframe the problem or to come up with a question, like a how might we question, how might we help women transport water? That might be the question. And then work on that together and start to brainstorm, come up with different ways of addressing that problem, then coming up with ideas, and then making it visual is the key. And we can do this with any business or any product development. It's all about making it visual so other people can see what you're thinking. And once you make it visual, then you can start to address it, or people can add to it, or then they can say, yes, that's what I had in mind, or no, I'd like to change that. This is really more what I was thinking. So there's a lot of that and a lot of observation as well, and a lot of iteration. So a lot of going back and testing it again.
And it sounds like, you know, if it doesn't work, you pick up what you can and you keep going.
Exactly.
Great. Well, Leslie, inspiring stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Leslie Sager runs the Interior Architecture Program at UW-Madison. She's also the director of the Design Thinking for Social Innovation Initiative at the School of Human Ecology, joining us here today to talk about using design thinking to build better lives.
Coming up, a climate scientist joins us to talk about the draft of a federal climate change report the New York Times published last night and possible responses and reactions from the Trump administration on that issue. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. This week, Latino USA looks at what's changing with immigration under President Trump and how those changes affect people in the real world. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, the New York Times published a draft federal climate change report last night. The report was finished this year, and it's part of the National Climate Assessment, which is congressionally mandated every 4 years. The National Academy of Sciences has already signed off on that draft report. The report's authors are now waiting on permission from the Trump administration to officially release it.
Alyssa Ago is a climate scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So in a broad overview, Alyssa, what's in this report? What does it contain?
So it is a synthesis of existing research to basically provide an assessment of the state of climate science. So it itself isn't original research, but it aggregates all of the most recent research in the past several years so that we have a good understanding of the causes, impacts, and solutions to climate change. And this particular report focuses more on the U.S.
And some news outlets had been reporting that this was a leaked report to the New York Times. Is it a leak or is this something that's out there?
Not really. When these reports are put together, there are several stages where different iterations of the report are open to public comment. And so this draft that we see on the New York Times is very, very similar to a draft that was available to the public since December. So this really isn't anything that was a big deal in terms of the science world. This report has been available in different drafts, and the one that we see right now on the New York Times website is very, very similar to the most recent draft that we saw in December.
By now, we have seen many reports on climate change. What kind of weight does this particular report carry among scientists?
This is a very one of several and really important reports that by all these agencies that come together to assess our current understanding. So we have on the international level, we have the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that has a focus on the whole globe and climate change at large, and that comes out every 5 to 7 years, and that is highly regarded in the field. And then for the more U.S.-centric climate information, this is really that report. So this is the National Climate Assessment, and the report that was published on the New York Times website is only one piece of the larger report that is due to come out in late next year, and it's a really good resource for scientists. It helps us synthesize everything that we see in the more specific papers that are published year-round.
Can you tell us a little bit about who was involved in putting the report together?
I think there are around 50 scientists that were involved in putting this report together. There will be many more scientists involved when the final report is put together. Again, this is just one piece of the full report. This is sort of the backbone for the rest of the report, which will go into more details about different regions of the U.S. as well as different sectors in the U.S., for example, like agriculture. And so these 50 scientists come from 13 different government agencies that all work on climate change issues. And then also several universities around the country were involved as well.
And this report is said to be striking in that it does ascribe human activity as a cause, sometimes to specific climate events. And, for instance, the 2003 heat wave in Europe. Can you tell us about some of that aspect linking human activity to climate change?
Absolutely. So for a really long time, we used to always say that, you know, you can't attribute a single isolated event to climate change because there's so much going on. Just as when you get, you know, the common cold, it can be multi-causal. There's all these different factors that contribute to you getting a cold. And so it's hard to know exactly which one factor played the largest role. Well, that's actually changed in the science world over the past several years. We've gotten to a place in science research that we actually are able to parse out the human influence on specific extreme events. Not all extreme events, but there are certain classes of extreme events that we have enough data to know what it's like in a normal world, that means without humans, versus a human-influenced world. And so, for example, for heat waves and for flooding and for even some drought situations, we're able to take everything we know about what would happen if humans weren't influencing our climate and then compare it to what's happening with humans influencing our climate. And based on those simulations, we're able to assess what percent of that event was made worse or more frequent because of the human influence on climate.
And you said that shift linking human activity to specific climate events, that's been happening for maybe a couple of years. But is there in this report, is there weight there given that you wouldn't have seen? Is it going to be in the spotlight more than it has been before?
I think over the past 10 years, it's getting more and more traction, this up-and-coming field of attributing specific events to climate change. So I think this report is just, you know, another step in that direction of putting it more in the forefront, because as time passes, we become more confident with our analytical methods to do these types of assessments. And then we are also seeing more events that we're able to apply this technique to. So I don't see this as all of a sudden, you know, I don't look at this report as all of a sudden there's this limelight on this this new attribution field, but it is just the continuation of a growing body of research that as time passes, we have stronger science and we also have more results to analyze.
We're talking right now to climate scientist Alyssa Acco from the Environmental Defense Fund, talking about a draft of a federal climate change report and what's expected from the Trump administration on this. And Alyssa, we touched on the human link there, which is one of the notable aspects of this report. What else? What are the other big headlines in terms of the content? What's in there?
So So there definitely is the highlight of the fact that the impacts are already occurring and are intensifying. I mean, we've definitely seen this shift over the past several years, with instead of climate change being this distant threat in the future of what we expect to happen, we are seeing more and more impacts already occurring. So it definitely emphasizes that. For example, the last National Climate Assessment Report was in 2014. And since then, we've seen a lot of record-breaking climate-related weather extremes. We've seen the three warmest years on record for the globe. 2014 was the warmest on record, and then 2015 beat 2014, and then 2016 beat 2015, and we are expected for 2017 to beat 2016. So those have all occurred since the last report. And we've also seen, you know, a drastic loss of sea ice in the Arctic. So all of those different events have gone into, and new observations and research have gone into this report since the last one.
And a change in temperature, a shift upward by 2 degrees Celsius, is supposed to be sort of the guardrail. If we get to there, there's still going to be some ramifications. We're going to feel the results. But do we know about whether the United States, whether the country and the world is poised to bust through that barrier and go beyond that 2 degrees Celsius?
I think it's very likely that we will surpass that threshold. It is important to note that that threshold is an aspirational international target. So whether or not we stay at 2, or let's say we reach 2.2, we're still trying to figure out what that means. So when we look at 2 degrees C as a threshold, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, we look at it as, you know, this target that we don't want to go above, but it's not like the entire climate system will break down after that point. So it's, you know, it's this target that we want to stay below. It is likely that we'll exceed it. If we don't curb our emissions of greenhouse gases, we do expect temperature to rise by 2.8 to 4.8 Celsius by late century, which is 5 to 7.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That is what this latest report says. And so that's very concerning. It is. A few degrees can do a lot.
Now, I want to shift a little and talk about the political aspect of this. Now, some scientists involved with this report say that they have concerns that it's possible the Trump administration could make moves to suppress this report based, I guess, on things that have been said in the past. Do you think that that's likely? Is that, do you think, a valid concern?
I think it's definitely a valid concern, because that is the precedent that the Trump administration has already put in place since the day they took office. And so it's absolutely a concern for me that reports like this will not be allowed to go through because of the other changes that they've already made that have, you know, downplayed the threat of climate change and spread false information. So, for example, they've removed key scientific facts from government websites. They've replaced experts with lobbyists and political operatives. And so, you know, we've seen them block information and silence scientists. So there's absolutely a concern that they'll block this information as well.
I mean, the information, at least this draft, is already out there. So is a bigger concern whether or not the Trump administration will stand by it?
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, these drafts are always made public throughout the process. But it just, it's more of a symbolic thing if they don't let this report be published in its entirety. If for anyone listening who's familiar with the last National Climate Assessment Report released in 2014, the website itself is this beautiful interface with a lot of great information, but at really accessible levels, and it's very well done. And so even though this report, you know, is already leaked online, it's almost 700 pages of text that barely anyone would read. If it doesn't go through, then it's not able to become this great resource online, this tool that people can use to go through the information in a much more comprehensible way than reading a report that's 700 pages long.
We're talking right now with climate scientist Alyssa Acco from the Environmental Defense Fund about the draft of a federal climate change report and what's expected from the Trump administration.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see the Trump administration do in response to climate change and in response to this this report that is in process? How would you like to see the government handle things when it comes to the environment, energy, and regulations? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're getting back now to our discussion with climate scientist Alyssa Acco about the draft of a federal climate change report that the New York Times published last night.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Trump administration will approve, should approve, the official release of this federal report? What kind of action do you think should be taken when it comes to climate change? What kind of effort would you like to see from the federal government, maybe even at the state level? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Mark joining us in Delavan. Mark, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to say?
I have more of a comment than a question. My concern is that, you know, since outside of the United States, there really isn't any question in the developed world about whether or not human beings, the activity of human beings is causing global climate change. So I find myself kind of despairing that even direct evidence of that there are actually events that have happened that we know are due to climate change, I find myself despairing that the Trump administration and everyone else who is a climate denier would take that seriously and do anything about it.
Mark, thank you for that call. And Alyssa, is that a fear? Do you think that, that's grounded, or you think that the science is there and that there's consensus?
The science is definitely there. There's definitely consensus within the scientific community, much like there is consensus across all other nations other than the U.S. So the caller is absolutely right. I mean, everywhere else you go in the world, developed or developing nations, they all know that, you know, it's climate change is caused by humans. I mean, it's not up for discussion. It's just a what can we do about it? And, you know, we're seeing a lot of countries request more information so that they can prepare for the future so that, you know, their jobs and livelihoods aren't impacted as severely as they otherwise would be if they weren't informed.
Well, thank you for that call. And I want to read you, Alyssa, a Facebook comment that we got from Michael. Michael says, climate change, and it's in quotes, climate change isn't real science because real science is verifiable by the predictions that it makes. If the predictions are proved false, then the hypothesis behind them is false. He says, where are the predictions? And predictions should be precise. Vague predictions mean that the hypothesis behind them is equally vague. What is your response to that?
So I think this person is, you know, bringing up the fact that science is rooted in these questions and answers, and is saying that when, you know, we get the answers, if they're, you know, if they tell us one thing, that we need to trust that. But the problem is in what this person is saying is that we have made predictions and we have seen those come to life. Science is about, you know, having a hypothesis and, you know, trying to refute it. And that is exactly what, you know, atmospheric and oceanic sciences does. Climate science is just sort of the body of the intersection of all these different sciences. But I mean, we have been studying climate change for a couple hundred years, and people don't realize this. This isn't a new thing. We understood the basic chemistry in the 1900s. So we've been asking and answering these questions for a really long time. And there were absolutely predictions that were made in the late 1800s that if we continued to burn coal as our fuel for energy, then we were going to see temperatures rise. And that is exactly what we saw. And that is just one example of countless examples of predictions that have been made based on human activities that have come true.
And I want to ask you, Alyssa, we talked a little bit about the anticipation about what the response from the Trump administration will be, some concern there among scientists. How would you articulate what is at stake if the Trump administration in this particular instance decides not to stand by this report or maybe presents an alternative explanation for the findings? What do you think is on the line?
I think it's mostly just very embarrassing for the U.S., and it's already starting to build a lot of resentment towards the U.S. So the rest of the world is still working to curb climate change. They're in agreement with one another. They are, you know, pursuing actions. They're taking leadership positions that the U.S. used to hold to advance climate action. So in terms of, you know, what will actually happen, it's more of just an embarrassment for the U.S. of, you know, that someday we're going to look back on and it's going to be similar to, you know, thinking that the world is flat when we realized it was round. So it's, you know, we're as sure about humans and climate change as we are that smoking causes cancer, that gravity exists. So it's just this huge embarrassment to this country that our government is so anti-science.
Let's take another caller. We've got Willem with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's very inconsistent. On one hand, we're told about the importance of STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, to the future of American jobs and well-being, and then we're denying science. So I think that's confusing. And the other thing is that the Republican Party, who are in the main deniers of climate change, are also have a strong, what they call a pro-life stance. And a recent study in Europe says that it'll be over 100,000 people a year by the end of the century that will perish from climate, you know, increased wind, sea rise, all the effects of climate change. So it's very inconsistent that they have a pro-life stance on one hand, and then this unethical, immoral, I believe, denial of, you know, what's obviously happening to anyone that's paying attention. You know, anyone that's, there's empirical evidence as well as scientific evidence.
Willem, thanks for that call. And Alyssa, any response to what Willem had to say there?
I think that's a really interesting perspective. I absolutely agree that is a big inconsistency. And I think part of this inconsistency comes from the fact that people sometimes view environmentalists as caring more about the environment than people. I know that that's something that I've been mislabeled in the past because I study environmental issues that, you know, I care more about the tree next door, for example, than the child next door. And what I care about climate change, because it affects everyone, and it is certainly a human issue as much as it is an issue for all other biological life. And so certainly is a concern that if we do nothing, and it's not even just a concern, it is a fact that if we don't do anything about climate change, we will have premature deaths as a result from intensifying extreme weather events, from sea level rise, from, you know, many different aspects of life. And so it absolutely is a concern that, you know, it will harm human life. And that is something that the pro-life community should, you know, care about because they are so pro-life. And so I think that's a really interesting point.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alyssa Acco is a climate scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund, and she was with us there to talk about the draft of a federal report on climate change that was published in the New York Times last night.
Still time to share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.